Thanks, Frank. I'm Patty, and I'm an Al-Anon. I want to thank Clay for asking me to come today and be here and share this all with you and to share your meeting here on the lake, in the beautiful lake. I come from Los Angeles, the sort of the western part, and when I left, it was overcast, about 75 degrees, and crowded. I like being here where it's bright and sunny and about 75 degrees and uncrowded. It's really nice. I joined Al-Anon a little over 19 years ago, and I didn't come here willingly. I came here because the alcoholic in my life, who Frank told you was my husband, Ken, wasn't doing it my way. He just wouldn't shape up and ship right. I kept telling him, just don't drink. And I've discovered here, fortunately, that that's not what one tells an alcoholic. When I got here, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, the disease. I knew that something was wrong. I didn't know what. I couldn't put a label on it. I wasn't raised with alcoholism. I was in a profession at one point where I sentenced people to Al-Anon and Alateen and AA, but I didn't really know anything about the disease. And if you break that word down, it's dis-ease, and I certainly was full of dis-ease. I was uneasy all the time. The form of alcoholism in our life was strictly that. My husband's a wino. He'll tell you that. We were very careful to keep track of our wines, but he's basically a wino. And what we did in our Dance of Death, it does talk about that, the merry-go-round of despair that in some of our literature and things that you'll see, we played this sort of Dance of Death. He'd drink, I'd be unhappy, which would probably make him drink more because I'd talk to him about not drinking, and then he'd drink more, and then I'd get unhappy, and you just keep going round and round and round, and nothing stops until it gets too late. Hold on a minute. It's my important paper. We ended up taking what was termed a geographic, which means that we went somewhere else, and we took us with us, unfortunately, including drinking habits and my worrying. We went to Australia for a year. We'd planned this for a couple years. I didn't realize that when we did that, as I stood in the airport loading us all up, and at that point we had 12 bags, two kids, and him and me, and we're taking all of us, including the drinking, to Australia for a full year, away from any kind of support group, away from any kind of people that we knew on any kind of level where we could talk carefully about things. And guess what? We sort of poured them on that airplane. I stood in that airport and I said, it's going to be different. And I remember that vividly, standing in the middle there, looking at all this stuff going on. I said, he'll relax. He won't have to drink so much because all the stuff to get us there is gone. You know, the house is rented. He's finished up his job, that stuff. There's not going to be any problems in Australia. Well, I didn't realize, really, that Australians drink pretty hard. They're kind of a good group. As we left the airport, the person who picked us up stopped by the store to pick up six-pack. Now, Australian six-packs are 750-ml bottles of good beer, strong beer. So he had three of those that night in a couple hours, and he wasn't feeling too good. And at that point, we know today, at least I know today, that he had his first sort of coming out of it kind of things. He was sweating, he was smelling, he was unhappy, he was up and down and couldn't sleep, and I thought it was all due to jet lag. It's called denial. That's some of the other things that you heard here so far today. I denied for a long time there was any kind of problems. So he swore off for a little bit, as people do. I didn't know people did that. I was happy. But by the end of the week, things were doing okay, so he began drinking again. Not a problem. I discovered that in my disease of Al-Anonism, I became very helpful to this poor man. I watched him drink. I bought his booze. I kept track of his booze very carefully. And we'd buy wine by four-liter boxes. That's when they first came out. It was the first time I'd ever seen him. I bought wine in four-liter boxes. And I'd keep looking at my one glass, and I'd say, how come we're empty already? And he'd say, well, you just drank more. I said, but I only had one. He said, no, you must have had more. So I began to believe what he was telling me. I didn't believe my own self. And this, I believe, is where I began to lose myself. I lost my sense of self. Because if you can't believe what you see, what you smell, or what you hear, or even what you think, you're nobody. At least that's my opinion. Because he told me, and obviously he tells it in a big, deep voice, so he's right. Has to be. So I'm losing myself, and we lost more. Sometime during that year, he had sort of a binge. We learned, I learned after joining Al-Anon that it was a binge. It was about 2 or 3 days. He self-medicated because he got sick, so he self-medicated himself for 24 hours around the clock for a few days. And we got a little worried. Blood pressure shot up, things like that. We called in a doctor. Doctor gave him some funny pills. And he said to me, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And being the good Al-Anon, I said, oh, no, dear. You can't be. You're just sick. Chose to say that, you know, A, I'm in denial still, and B, I don't know a thing about alcoholism. Not a thing. You know, I keep looking back, particularly when I was new in the program, and I thought, all those missed opportunities. I could have jumped on the bandwagon right there and said, yes, you dodo, you're an alcoholic. But I didn't know. I didn't know. And what my job is to find out about the disease of alcoholism. Well, the disease in our life progressed, and we kind of poured him on the plane to come back home when the time came. He had some serious physical problems with the disease of alcoholism. We were really worried about his physical health at this point. We poured him back off the plane into L.A., and we got hit with life. You know, life goes on, and I'm getting really angry. What I'm getting angry is that he's not there for me. He's not doing it. We'd rented the house. I had to take care of the house. I had to take care of the cars. I had to take care of his mother. She was having some surgery. I had to collect the kids and get them organized. And I was, as it says here in our book, in our phrase she just read, we feel cheated out of a loving companion, overburdened with responsibilities, unwanted, unloved, and alone. And that's how I was here. I came here, back here, into the States, and I was unwanted, unloved, and alone, because he wasn't there. He couldn't be there, but I didn't know that. I thought he could. And I was really getting angry as to why the heck wasn't he being there for me, taking care of it for me. Well, we managed to scrape through that, and he just kept drinking more and more and more, and it was getting worse and worse and worse, and I was getting crazier. But I have another profession here, and I learned that in that profession you do things. So what I did was I started calling people. I started calling the AA hotline. And they're very nice people in L.A. You know, one of them stays up till 11 o'clock at night, so you can call till 11 o'clock at night. Another one runs 24 hours a day, so you can call them anytime, day or night. And I did. And I said, I got this guy, and I'd like you to come get him. And they figuratively patted me on the head, said, yes, dear, do you know about Al-Anon? I said, well, yes, of course I know about Al-Anon, but you don't understand, he's the one with the problem. And they said, well, we suggest you go to a meeting. So I said, okay. And I never went because he had the problem and I was perfectly okay. Thank you very much. Now, during this time, I discovered later on, of course, in working my Al-Anon program, that I wasn't too tightly wrapped at this point in time. You know, the kids are being kids, as they are. They were 6 and 9 at the time. And I've got 2 cats, a dog, him, and the 2 kids to all worry about. And I was a great worrier. That's why I'm all gray today. That's what's from. Since I figured AA hotline wouldn't help come get them, and they kept really telling me they didn't want to come get them. I really suggested they did, but they kept telling me no. I decided, well, we'd take them to the Alcoholism Council. National Association of Alcoholism Council or something like that. And so I kind of poured them in the car and drove them over there, and they said, well, you had to be sober for a day before they'd help them. So I said, fine, just don't drink. Yeah, well, you know what that means to an alcoholic. They drink more, which is, of course, what he did. And that's where I bought his big book, by the way. Just thought I'd let you know. I bought him his big book. I read it for him. I left it open on his nightstand to the right appropriate pages that applied directly to him. Today I don't do those things. He still has that big book, by the way, and he'll tell you I bought it for him. Well, maybe someday you'll hear his story. I try real hard to stay out of his life and not tell his story, though. I got to tell some of his story for you, because that's part of my story. Because this is a family disease. We're all affected by it. After that, I just kept calling AA hotline some more, because he wasn't getting any better. He was getting worse, and he was being drink, round-the-clock binge-type drinking. And I got real worried that people would see and notice. And I began to hide cars. I hid our cars, because I didn't want him to wreck any of our cars. So I hid his car, I hid my car, and I thought that was perfectly okay. I sometimes lost them. You know, the alcoholic never had a problem with any of this stuff. He always found those cars. No matter where I put them, he found them. I haven't quite figured that one out yet. Maybe they're good at doing this stuff. But I would hide them, and he would drive, and I would buy his booze. Finally, I got angry at him one day and said, I'm not going to buy your booze anymore. I didn't know that I was doing the right thing. But I didn't buy him booze anymore. But I drove him to buy the booze. See, this is not what I've learned today is real good behavior. Someone identifies over there. To me, it seemed perfectly normal that I should drive this person to drive his to get his booze. The other things that I did were things that I'm not proud of today. Of course, the kids were just hanging around, rattling around the house at that point, and not much care was being given to them. And I always told them, hurry up. be quiet, hurry up, be quiet, hurry up, be quiet, daddy's sick, hurry up, be quiet, daddy's sick. I didn't know I was telling the truth. Daddy was sick, but I didn't know it. I was trying to cover up and do a lie. I was convinced I was lying to these boys, that daddy was sick. And I was getting angry and angry and resentful, and I almost began to hate this man because he wasn't doing it my way. Well, guess what? The end result of all this stuff was that he got really bad, and his last binge lasted about 12 days. And during those 12 days, I spent a lot of time watching him breathe. I'd come home. Let me back up just 1 second here, get ahead of myself. The last thing I ever did for this man, I shouldn't say the last thing, but probably the last thing that I did to try and prevent him from drinking was to take him to our doctor. I poured him in the car one more time, dumped him off at the doctor, and he passed out on the exam room floor. And I'm mortified. How could he do this to me? I'm terribly embarrassed. The doctor came in, took one look at this body on the floor and said, "Come here, lady. Come into my office." He looked at me and he said, "Lady, he's drunk." I said, "What? How could he be?" Well, this happened to be the one doctor in this particular medical facility that was the alcoholism doctor. And he got me into the outpatient clinic along with my husband. To go to the outpatient clinic, I just want you to picture this. We had a VW Bug at the time. This man's about 6 feet, kind of a big guy. And he never quite made it right on time for the appointment, so I was going to make sure he made those appointments. And one day he escaped from me, and he was out in the car, buying a little courage to go to the appointment. And I'm hanging, he finally kind of drove up to our house, and he's just kind of sliding by. He can't quite stop at the right point, so he's just sort of braking and going on down the street. And I'm in the driver's side, trying to pull on the emergency brake across him, sticking out of the car while it's moving. I finally get the car stopped. I get him up and over the gear shift without damaging anything, get him strapped in, and I get in, and we take off to the doctor. That was our pattern for going to the doctor to get help. The other pattern we had was that when we're done with the doctor, and they talked to me about Al-Anon there too, and I'm saying, but, you know, he's the one with the problem. I'm fine. Thank you very much. I'm fine. And guess what? What he did was have to stop, of course, at a place to buy a little booze on the way home. Because if you're going to have your urine tested, you can't drink while you're there. You certainly ought to be able to drink afterwards. So we did that for a while. That's the kind of dance we did. Was we'd buy, he'd buy a little bit on the way too. He'd be okay there. They'd talk to me about Al-Anon. I'd say thank you, nod my head like I knew what I was doing, and not do it. And then we'd buy a little bit of something on the way back to get him home. Going back to this last binge he was on, if I would go out for any reason and take the kids with me, I'd come back in. I'd have to crack that door of the bedroom just a little bit to make sure he was breathing. If I saw the chest rising or the covers rising on the bed, I knew he was still alive, and I didn't have to call 911 and take him away. I was deathly afraid of coming back and finding a dead body, because he was a nice, quiet, stay-at-home drunk. If you got to have one, I recommend them, because they don't do much. He was a smoker at the time. I always worried about the house burning down before I got back. But after a while, I really didn't care. I figured if he was the only one gone, that was fine. I don't believe that's normal mental health today. I don't believe watching people breathe is something that most of us have to do today either. I know I don't have to watch him breathe anymore, but I physically could not go into the house without looking through that door to see if he was still alive or not. It was this compulsion that I had. As the alcoholic has a compulsion to drink, I had a compulsion to watch the alcoholic. And that's how come I'm here today, is because of my compulsions about the alcoholic. I finally went to Al-Anon because one more time I called that AA hotline, and one more time they said, "Yes, dear, you really need to go to Al-Anon." But this time there was a difference. That AA person on the other end of that line had an Al-Anon directory on him. And they said, "Here's some meetings. Time, where do you live? Here's a meeting in your area." And I said, "Oh, but I have little children. I can't go." Guess what? The little children, they said, there's meetings with child care in our area, which was the only thing that got me to a meeting in the first place, was a meeting with child care. They took away all my excuses for going. And guess what? I went to that first meeting, and I'll remember to this day. I didn't really believe what you were doing here at the meeting, but what I felt in that meeting was love, because I knew I was unlovable, because it says so in our little paper here. We are unloved. We're unwanted, and we're alone. No one else cares about us, because he isn't doing it, or she, depending on your situation. They're not doing it. They're not giving us ours. So I got it from the meeting. I don't remember much about that meeting, but I do remember a few things. One of the things I remember is I cried during the whole thing. And they just kept handing me Kleenex. They just said, "Here." Capandemy Kleenex. And they asked me to say my name, and I couldn't hardly get my name out because I was crying. And they just handed me Kleenex. And guess what? They talked about a couple things that I did here, and what I did here was that I didn't cause it, I can't cure it. And I have to detach from this person. To me, unfortunately, that meant not love him anymore. That meant go away from him. And I wasn't ready to do that. So they talked to me after the meeting, and what they talked to me about was things like keep coming back. It'll be different. And I was afflicted at this time with what I like to call the he-he's. The he-he's, I've said a few of them today, are, but he did this, or he said that, or he's doing this, and he. I had no me, because me was lost, totally lost. I was also afflicted with the yabbits. Every time, anybody hear about a yabbit before? A yabbit is when these nice, kind, well-meaning people come up to you and say things like, keep coming back, dear, it'll get better. Yeah, but you don't understand. They say, but we do. Yeah, but I'm different. Yeah, but I'm unique. Yeah, but my case is so bad. And you know, you turn out and you find out that your case ain't so bad after all. There just isn't. Your case is perfectly normal for a member of a family disease. You're perfectly normal. The other things that we did during that time, I discovered in Al-Anon, was that I had to let him go. And I truly do mean that, let him go. I had to detach from this man. That didn't mean I left him, because I didn't. But I had to begin to save myself, and because my responsibility at that time was with the kids, I had to help them too. And people told me things like, what I can do for these children is to start being a better mom to them, start paying attention to them, something simple. I'd lost them too, practically, because my whole focus was on the alcoholic, not on the children, who are my responsibility if you look at a person who's drunk and a person who's not. You know, they're my responsibility. I didn't want them at that point. But they said I had to, so I did. I began trying not to yell at him so much, trying not to say hurry up so much, trying not to make excuses for Daddy. By this time, they're telling me that alcoholism is a family disease. It is a disease. So I'm saying, okay, I can tell him he's sick and be truthful this time. So I kept telling him, Daddy's sick. You know, we like to think our children aren't affected by this disease, and I'm afraid they are. My husband didn't really believe it when we talked about it with a counselor. He didn't understand about the disease as a family aspect either. And he didn't want the kids to go to, in our case, Alitot. We had a program for the smaller, younger children in our area, and he didn't want them to go because he was afraid they'd know that he was an alcoholic. And fortunately for me, I didn't have to get in there and try and prove to him that they already knew he was an alcoholic. We had an outside party do that, the counselor, which was one of our benefits that we were able to have living where we do. He went through a hospital program like Frank, a few years before Frank did, and through those counselors we learned an awful lot about the disease of alcoholism. They kind of put us on the right road. They told us what it was like in terms of family interactions. And they convinced him that the kids were affected too. So the kids went with me to meetings for a long time, and you know, today they're pretty okay. I'll get into that in just a minute here. What this early part of going to meetings was, this was before he actually got sober. And every time I left, I had to come back, and I was really afraid the house would burn down. And my prayers at that time were numerous. They were the why me gods. How come it's happening to me, God? Why me? As though I had some corner on trouble in life. As I was the only one afflicted with these problems. I suffered from terminal uniqueness. I heard that in a meeting one time. I really liked that idea. If I'd been any more unique, I might not have made it here. But the nice thing about it was that you come to enough meetings here and you hear your story. I was told that in one of my early meetings. You stick around long enough, you'll hear your story. And gee, you know, I did. In about a week's time, I heard someone who had almost the same identical aspect. Our husbands were in the same business. We each had two kids. We were going through about the same things. I also heard an old-timer at that point in time tell me there's only one alcoholic. They just travel from house to house doing the same thing. So we're all the same. You know, we might have different situations, different family configurations, doesn't matter. But we're all the same. The feelings are the same. I heard some people before this particular meeting talking about going to meetings in other places. And guess what? The feelings are the same. We all suffer from all of these feelings. They're exactly the same. It doesn't matter who we are or what we are. They're the same. And we come to Al-Anon to learn to use our program so that we can grow and change. I began going to a lot of meetings. I sat on people's doorsteps because I couldn't go home, because home was so awful at that point. He was still drinking, and he was really in his last days of drinking. And I would go sit on people's doorsteps. They told me I could. And then they'd take me in, and they'd feed me. And they'd make sure I could make it home. And they'd say, call anytime, night or day. And I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I don't want to bother you with my problems. It's called the martyr simplex or complex or whatever. And it's also known as the Al-Anon salute. Oh, me. I'm so bad off. You can't help me. I've heard many phrases in Al-Anon, and I just love them. One of them I heard was, get off the cross. We need the wood. So you got to stop being a martyr at some point in time. And as I began my travel and journey in Al-Anon, I learned a number of things. One, I learned I can't hide cars. I got to allow him at least one. So I hid mine, allowed him one. I decided he would have the older, smaller car because I needed the bigger, newer car for the kids. And I thought I was doing real good. And then they said that I actually had to tell this man what I was doing. And I'd not talked to him for quite a while by this point in time, any meaningful conversation. I said, I can't do that because he's going to do it. I never knew what it was, but I knew he'd do it if I told him what I was doing. So I kept doing it, and they kept telling me, I really got to tell him. You know, I got to tell him how I feel. And I was really afraid that he would do something. And so I would go in, I'd tell him little bits. You know, I'm going out. Then finally I got brave enough, I was going to say, I'm going to a meeting, and I'd leave right away, so there was no response. Well, you know, if they're drunk and passed out, there's no real response anyway, but I was afraid there would be. But there never was, but I was still afraid. And that's one of our things that we have in our reading today, fear. We come filled with fear here. That fear began to leave because as I did things, and there was no response from the alcoholic, I kept doing them, and I got better. I began to change. The Al-Anon program has really saved me, I think, from Camarillo State Hospital, which is a mental hospital in California. In case any of you know it, it's no longer that. They've made it something else. But I was really convinced I was going to get there eventually. But it saved me from that, because what it told me was that I'm normal for a family member of this disease. You know, all the feelings I have are perfect normal. Yes, I'm going to feel rage. Yes, I'm going to feel anger. I didn't feel when I got here. I didn't feel anything, because I couldn't, because they were too awful. You don't hate the person you live with. It's just not nice. Well, I learned that I can hate, and I can have fear, and I can have rage. But, you know, I can't take them out on another human being. I've got to learn some other way of doing it. And the way you do it is through the steps. You start with step one. Step one says, I'm powerless over alcohol. And Al-Anon, we learn you also have to say, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. And for myself, I have to also add, I'm powerless over other people's attitudes. Because I don't care what kind of attitude you're having today. If I make your attitude my attitude, it's going to be a bad attitude. And that's as simple as that goes. And I've done that. Even after being on the program for years, I can do that easy if I don't watch myself and I don't keep up with my meetings and I don't keep doing service and doing things like I'm doing right now and knowing how it was. So I don't like your attitudes. Mine are bad enough. Thank you very much. So what I had to do was do step one. My life is unmanageable. I did admit my life was unmanageable, but he was the cause of my life being unmanageable, naturally. I had to learn that I'm the cause of my life being unmanageable, because if I don't do my life right, then I'm responsible for my life. And it's my fault, not his. I wanted him to fix me. And they told me that's not going to happen. He is not... Rather, I'm not his responsibility. I am my responsibility. Step two, came to believe. I'd always had a higher power, but he was doing it to me. He was pointing that finger saying, you're in trouble, lady. I had to learn and change my higher power's viewpoint. Actually, what happened was I changed my viewpoint of my higher power. So where now my higher power today loves me, allows me to do things. I've come to believe in the softer, gentler way. And I have a really good relationship with my higher power today. Because I know my higher power, as they say in the program, doesn't give me anything I can't handle. It may seem like I can't handle it at the moment because of what's going on. But I do have the ability to handle anything that comes down today. And life happens. When you get on the program, doesn't mean life's going to stop and you're not going to have any troubles, no matter what they are. It means you're just going to look at them a different way and be able to handle them better. That's all. Step three. Made a decision to turn my will over. Well, I think that's step three. I can't remember at this point. Is that step three? Yeah, good. Okay. Going right along here. Step three. I had to do that. And now I have to do it on a daily basis. When I got here, I'd only do it when life was really tough. when I really couldn't handle it, then I would begrudgingly turn my life over to my higher power because I wasn't convinced my higher power would do it right because I wanted to be in control and do it my way and tell my higher power how to do it for me. So it took me about 6 months really to come along to that one. And I remember vividly the first time I ever did turn it over. I don't remember what it was today, I have to admit. But I was so angry at something in my life that I was practically livid. And I was due for a meeting, and I made a bargain with God. I said, okay, God, if you think this is really going to work, I'll turn it over to you. I really will. And I'm going to go to my meeting. And when I come back in an hour and a half, I will take it back, and I will work on it some more. And you know, I went to a meeting. I never really had to work on it anymore because it went away. And, you know, that evening I finally remembered, hey, yeah, I was really angry earlier today. And I turned it over, and I didn't remember about it until now in the evening. And that must mean this stuff works because God took it. So I didn't have to worry about it for the rest of the day. Today I use what we call God box, which is, it can be anything. I know people that have God envelopes. I know a lady who has a God vase. And what I do with my God box is I write down whatever my troubles are, including people, however often I have to write them down, and I put them in that God box. And I say, okay, God, it's yours. And sometimes I get a little arrogant, and I give God a time limit. I say, okay, I'm going to take it back, and you know, whenever I want to take it back. Usually it's 8 o'clock the next morning, because that's when I can do things. And you know, most of the time, I don't have to take it back anymore. Most of the time. Occasionally, because I'm human and I'm not perfect, says that in our readings too, I do take them back. Especially when I'm dealing with people. But you know, I get to turn them over again another day, another time. So it doesn't matter how often. God doesn't care how often I turn it over. I can turn it over every 20 seconds if I choose. Doesn't matter. And I can let it go for as long as I let it go for, and it doesn't matter. Anything is better than nothing. I like turning it over. I did my 4-step kind of late in life, so to speak. I don't recommend it that way. But I got so busy the first few years trying to figure out how to live life. A, with a sober alcoholic. B, was just trying to figure out what this disease was and what my part in it was and how to live again, that I didn't do it till a while in. But once I did do it, I really, really enjoyed the experience. And I know the Dodi last night spoke about doing her an Al-Anon 12-step, 4-step, pardon me, in the Blueprint for Progress. That's how I did mine, the Blueprint for Progress, which it identified feelings for me because I couldn't identify very many. When I got here, I knew I was angry and rage-filled, and I was fearful. But I added some extras after reading that particular book. It's a really great book. If you don't have it, I highly recommend it, even if you don't use it for your 4-step, because it identifies feelings. And there's a lot more feelings than I ever knew I ever had. And I've had them all now. It's really great that way. Worked with one. I actually had two. I read my 4-step to a second sponsor because my first one moved away. Had to get another one. That was a very scary thing. Because you start working with someone and you really build up a nice relationship. You know that they're willing to listen to you no matter how weird it sounds, how awful it is, how terrible it is, they're willing to listen to you and share their benefit of their experience, strength, and hope in that situation. And I've learned, at least in my program, that if someone doesn't have that particular experience, they're willing to tell me that someone else may. Yeah. No one has to be a know-it-all here. We have a big, huge resource amongst all of us. And if my experiences that I'm going through aren't yours, then maybe you know someone who has had mine, and you can direct me to that person. I can discuss things with them. That's how my program works. You know, 6 and 7 maybe. You just simply work some more, and you begin to be humble. I was afraid of humble because that to me meant being a doormat one more time. And I discovered it isn't. It means working with a higher power to the point where you can say to your higher power, I'm not perfect. And your higher power believes you. And you believe yourself. And you don't have to do it perfectly. You can do it to the best of your ability any day and time. Steps 8, of course, you make a list of those people you'd harmed. Well, I listed, you know, the people that I'd hurt mostly. Family members and so forth. Then my sponsor said, you know, one more person you got to put on there, and that's yourself. Because you'd hurt yourself, too. And you got to make amends eventually to yourself, too. And she's right. Now, I discovered that. I had to forgive myself for not being as perfect person, for not taking advantage of those opportunities when we were in Australia to get the alcoholic sober, for not realizing what this disease was. I was told I did the best I could with the information I had at the time, and I got real guilty about dealing with the kids at that point in time because I yelled at them. You know, I wasn't a real nice mom at that point. And I had to forgive myself for doing the best I could with the information I had at that time. I couldn't have done any different or any better at that time. So I had to forgive myself. So I had to do a step 9 for me, as well as the other people in my life, whoever they were. And then, of course, 10, 11, and 12, as I say, are the maintenance steps. That's what I do. I try to do on a regular basis so that I can keep my program. You know, I've learned a lot of things through this program. One of the things I've learned is that no matter what happens in life, you can get through it. I forget exactly when, but let's see. Probably close to 10 years ago now, my mom had cancer, colon cancer. And we got the call, and I was to go out to be with her for her surgery. And it looked really bad. In fact, the doctor said they weren't certain whether or not she'd survive because she was older at the time and she had a heart condition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we were sure we were maybe going to lose her eventually. Well, I'm here to tell you that was about 10, 12 years ago. She's still kicking around, doing her thing. She's 85 now. I think she had the surgery at 72, so I guess that's about 13 years. And this was a lady the doctor said, 6, 9 months, somewhere in there. 13 years later, she's still here. So you got to have a little faith. That brings back faith that it's going to be okay. What I did during that time was I talked to a lot of Al-Anons. After the day I got the phone call was my regular scheduled home group meeting. I went to that meeting, and I'm talking about my mom and the cancer surgery. And after the meeting, a man came up and said, my mom had cancer surgery, same kind, 4 months ago, and this is what happened to me. And he shared his experience, strength, and hope with me. That's how my program works. Somebody's got what I have. I just have to start talking about what I have so people out there know what I have so they can share their experience, strength, and hope with me. Because they have it too. You know, stick around long enough, you'll hear your story, no matter what it is. You know, my kids went through teenagehood. Now, I think that's a disease all by itself. We had one, you know, we had the family dynamics. We had the good kid and the bad kid. The good kid was one of these bright, underachieving kids. He's really a bright kid, but he didn't do it. He just floated by. He thought C's were okay, driving his father and I up the tree. I actually had to work this program on that kid. I bugged him probably for 3 weeks straight at one period in time in his life, trying to get him to turn in his homework. You know, that's all you have to do is turn in your homework. All you have to do is stop drinking. Same thing. Meant the same way. I was convinced this kid was going to be an alcoholic, and I said that in one meeting, and one of these wise old women came over to me, and she said, but you know, he might not. I never considered that option. I had him down the gutter already. It doesn't work that way. I don't see my options because I have tunnel vision. And it takes me talking to people like you, sharing in meetings, to get out of my tunnel so I can see a wider view. Because without you, I can't do it. It's that simple. Well, that kid kind of got through okay. The next one comes up, and the next one's one of those bad kids. He's the one out there trying a little bit of that funny stuff, smoking it, trying a little bit of that funny beer, coming in kind of green, not eating too well, making runs for the toilet because as we talk about food, he's getting greener and greener. And guess what? It came down to the point when my alcoholic said to me, it's either the kid or me. You got to choose. We can't live like this anymore. And one more time, my back's to the wall, and I don't know what to do. But it popped in my head because I'd been around Al-Anon for a little while that maybe I could ask for help. What a concept. Ask for help. So I called someone, some counselor that I knew, that happened to be a program person, and we went for family counseling. Not a long time, but long enough to get all of us straightened out and find, right, this kid still drinks today. I don't appreciate it, but he still does. He's living his life. These kids now are 28 and 26. So they're big people nowadays. I can't tell them what to do or not do. But, you know, I can still get back into this disease of Al-Anonism anytime I want. That's why I have to keep coming back to these meetings. A few years ago, about 3, 4 years ago, we were up in Alaska. And the older kid had to go home because his vacation was up. And the young kid stayed with us for another week. I don't know, he was 22 or 23, something like that. And guess what? He bought some beer. And we're traveling in a camper around Alaska for a week, the three of us. My husband's sober today. So we've got a sober alcoholic, a semi-sober Al-Anon, and a definitely not sober kid traveling in a camper for a week. Now, the kid bought the first, he bought 2 6-packs at first. Who's counting, right? I realized one more time that my keen Al-Anon senses have never left me. Because when the alcoholic was still drinking, I developed the keen Al-Anon senses. In case you don't know, that's a sense of smell. Hi, dear. Hi, dear. How are you? You okay today? You know, just checking him out, make sure what he's smelling like, so I know what he's like when he walks in the door. The keen Al-Anon sense of hearing. I can tell the difference between a Mickey's pull tab and a Coors pop top at 50 paces. Truth. Now, I'm sitting in the front of this camper, And he's opening that refrigerator back there, that kid is. And he's pulling out, and I can tell which one he's pulling out. And I can tell whether it's the flip top or the pop top. But who's counting? Who's listening? I'm getting weirder and weirder. In Alaska, in the summertime, it kind of stays light. We pull in for camping around 9, 10 o'clock at night, whatever. And I have to admit, I did go back, and I counted how many beers he'd had on our trip out. And I'll tell you if you want to ask me after the meeting. That's the Al-Anon thinking. One more time, I'd gotten sick. You know, so what my husband and I did, and he wasn't too happy about this kid either, we had to walk away from that, and we had to have our own meeting right with us, right where we were. We said the Serenity Prayer, and we always take our books with us, and we take some tapes, because when you're out traveling out in distances, that's the only way we found of having a good meeting, because we know each other's story. And I know his better than he does, from my viewpoint. And guess what? We had a meeting. You know, we walked away from that kid, let him do what he had to do, and the rest of the trip was okay. But I've also learned in Al-Anon that I get to tell people how I feel. I have some carefulness in this, though. I was told I could only do it if I followed the formula. The formula that was given to me was I had to do it in two, count them, two, short sentences, an I message, in a loving, caring, non-judgmental way. Now, you try and talk to an alcoholic like that. Took me a long time to figure out how to say anything to the alcoholic originally. Then with this kid, it took me about 2 hours to be able to say what I need to say to this kid. And I can't remember exactly how I phrased it, but it was something on the order of, it upsets me when you drink like that. Would you please, or could you please, not drink like that? I didn't say don't drink. I said don't drink like that. The rest of the trip, he was okay. Today, I don't know if he's an alcoholic or not. At times, I really believe he is, and someday he'll join us here. Who knows? But then I keep remembering that wise old lady who looked at me and said, maybe he's not. Maybe he's just drinking a lot. I don't know. I can't say. But what I do know is that he's doing life fine. He's got an advanced degree. He's got a job. He supports himself. So does the older kid. What can I do? You know, they're doing their thing. I'm not in charge of their lives anymore, so one more time, I got to let them go. So when I find myself getting into their lives, they've had enough Alateen in them that they look at me and they say, hey, Mom, let go. My husband looks at me and he says, you need a meeting. And I probably do when I get on my high horse. So those are the things that I've learned in this program. You know, the things that have happened to me, like happened to everybody else. My dad passed away a couple years ago. My mom had a stroke. It happened to be during the time of the International Convention. I guess more than a few years ago now. It was 95. And I'm out in there. They were living in Boulder City, Nevada at that point. And I'm in L.A. And I got the call that my mom had a stroke. And my dad at that point was bedridden, and she was taking care of him. So we hurried up, got planes, got out there, take care of her for a while. Take care of Dad until we figured out what was going on. And after a couple weeks of being out there, I'm getting a little screwy. Because in Boulder City, Nevada, there's one meeting a week. It's on Fridays, 10 o'clock. And that's the time that I was visiting my mom, or I was leaving to go back to L.A. for the weekend, and my sister was coming in for the weekend because we were sort of tag-teaming it with these folks. And guess what? After a couple weeks of missing a Friday night meeting that I began to go to with my alcoholic husband, we went to an AA meeting every Friday night. That's our Friday night date. Because after a while, you get tired of not going out. Because I've discovered that if alcoholics go to five meetings a week, they don't want to go out on the weekends. And I got angry. So we agreed we'd have a date. So we go to an AA meeting. That gets me out of the house. Keeps me sober, mentally sober, and keeps him sober, physically, and we both got a good deal, and we're out together. I missed a couple meetings, and Pat and Frank were still in L.A. at that time. And I guess it was that third week that I was out there, and I was getting really screwed because the alcoholic just wasn't doing it. He just wasn't commiserating with me. He was complaining about things, about doing the laundry, about cooking his own meals. And here I am dealing with my dad. That he was, as I said, bedridden, doing everything, visiting Mom in the hospital, taking care of her and their stuff. And I have a bigger problem than he is, but he's complaining. And I was really upset with him, and I wasn't getting to my Al-Anon meetings. And Pat called at the Friday night meeting. She called from the payphone outside that meeting. She spoke to me for 45 minutes on a payphone about dealing with stroke, because she'd gone through that with her mother. All you have to do is reach out the hand and say, I have a problem, and what is it? And someone has had that problem too. The only way I was able to survive the next 2 weeks was because I knew Pat was there. And Pat had talked to me about what it's like and dealing with the spouse who's left at home. So I began to be okay because I shared it and got rid of it. Thanks, Pat. The nice thing about all this stuff is you can live through anything. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, life, death, kids, taxes, the 405 freeway at 5 o'clock in the evening. I do that a lot. I drive a lot in my job. And guess what? I don't get flustered most of the time when those people are doing it wrong in front of me. They're not going fast enough. Or we've got that tanker that's spread across the freeway. And gee, we got to all go down four lanes into one. You know, I just sit there and I say, gee, it's a lovely day out. You know, it's all in the attitude. I can have a bad attitude and be upset and frustrated, but I don't have to. I'll close with one last little thought. Coming here, I'm in Prescott earlier this week and I'm driving. Well, there's road work in Arizona. Did you know that? What I discovered in Arizona is that those road work people know where I'm going, and they follow me. And they say, we're going to have the flag person just for her. Because coming out of Prescott, we went the other way, because we knew the way we would have gone had road work. Well, the other way had road work. Twice. Then I'm coming out of Flag, and I'm thinking, ah, got it made. No problems. Road work. Flag people. Twice. I'm going to have to drive back down to Flag. So would you all, as you leave, take care of the road work for me? Get it going. I want to thank you very much. I really enjoyed being here. I've enjoyed it, and it's part of my program is to share what little I know. Hopefully you all keep coming back, for those of you that are new, or newer anyway. Keep coming back.